Israeli regime strikes various locations in Gaza, including the southern city of Rafah, where at least 8 Palestinians are killed. EU leaders call for immediate humanitarian pause in Gaza as a prelude to sustainable ceasefire. And Israel forces conduct new raids across the occupied West Bank as part of their crackdown against Palestinians in occupied territories. Nearly 6 months into Israel's genocidal war on Gaza, and the regime's unrelenting bombardment and shelling continues to claim more Palestinian lives. The latest airstrikes hit Gaza City, killing at least 10 Palestinians, and earlier, a home was struck in the southern city of Rafah, where 8 people, mostly women and children, lost their lives. And 3 more people were killed in an airstrike in Khan Yunis, also in the south of Gaza. The Israeli regime began its war on Gaza back on October the 7th, and since then, almost 32,000 people have been killed in the Palestinian territory, most of them women and children. 7,000 people are also still unaccounted for and presumed buried under rubble, and over 74,000 Palestinians have been injured. And now, welcome everyone to the News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Day 5 of the Israeli regime's siege on the Al-Shifa medical complex, where over 30,000 Palestinians are taking shelter. That's according to the Gaza Health Ministry. The Palestinian officials say over a dozen patients have already died after they were deprived of medicine, and that is because Israeli forces have cut off their water and electricity there at the hospital, the largest in Gaza. They also abducted dozens of nurses, doctors, and hospital staff. The regime says siege will continue for several more days and ordered evacuation of patients, displaced civilians, and medical staff. And it claims Hamas fighters are inside the hospital and has already arrested over 300 of them. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has dismissed this. It says the attack on Al-Shifa is all part of systematic destruction of health facilities in Gaza. Hamas has also condemned what it called the shameful silence of the international community to stop the Israeli war. Joining us now for the program is Moti Abu Musabe from the central Gaza city of Deir al-Balah, and Isha Krishnaswamy, podcaster and journalist, joining us from St. Petersburg. Hello, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. Moti, we're going to obviously start with you there on the ground, the latest you can with respect to what is going on at Al-Shifa Hospital.
Well, first of all, let me say that over the last couple of hours, the Israeli occupation forces committed an appalling massacre after destroying another residential house in the western part of Gaza City and the surrounding areas of the Al-Shifa medical complex. 10 Palestinian dead bodies, mostly women and children, were extracted from that area after the Israeli warplanes destroyed the house over their heads. In the meantime, as you know, that the Israeli aggression against the Al-Shifa Square is still persistent so far. It entered its fifth consecutive day after the Israeli occupation forces began a swift attack against the Al-Shifa medical complex, claiming that there are many Palestinian resistance officials and seniors living there and taking shelter in the hospital, and they are operating and functioning from that area. They claimed once again that Al-Shifa is used as a command center by the Palestinian resistance, particularly Hamas movement, and as a result, they relentlessly attacked the buildings inside the Al-Shifa medical complex and even the surrounding areas. Till this moment, we are talking about hundreds of the Palestinian residential buildings were destroyed completely or partially over the continuous and the chronic Israeli airstrikes and the continuous shelling of the Israeli tanks and the heavy gunfire of the Israeli tanks and the Israeli soldiers. The Israeli soldiers actually rendered that area to be an unlivable place after forcibly expelling the Palestinian civilians and the Palestinian residents living there. They were forced to leave under the continuous Israeli attacks and the continuous Israeli bombardments over that area. Needless to mention that thousands of the Palestinian civilians who were taking shelter inside the hospital were also forcibly expelled after the Israeli occupation forces destroyed their houses, and they had no place to go but Al-Shifa hospital. Now the Israeli occupation forces once again attack them and force them to leave and to evacuate. Needless to mention also that there are hundreds of the Palestinian patients are still inside the medical complex. They are denied any real access to their basic medical care after the Israeli occupation forces abducted and kidnapped hundreds of the Palestinian paramedics and the medical staff, in addition to the cutoff of the electricity and the oxygen supplies. We are talking about catastrophic humanitarian conditions that are befalling the Palestinian civilians either inside the Al-Shifa medical complex or about the surrounding areas and the vicinity of the medical complex. According to multiple eyewitnesses, that dozens of the Palestinian dead bodies are still scattered in the streets of the surrounding areas of the Al-Shifa medical complex as the Israeli occupation forces are still attacking the area. The constant and the continuous Israeli bombardments have never stopped for a while, for roughly five consecutive days. And now the Israeli occupation forces are still depriving and still preventing the Palestinian medical staff and the Palestinian ambulances from evacuating those dead bodies. We are talking about another brutal aggression waged by the Israeli occupation forces, inflicting more destruction and more death in that area.
Thank you, Moti and Isha. Welcome to the program. Now, Isha, we have heard the term indiscriminate Israeli bombardment of civilian infrastructure from week one, since the first week of after October 7th, Israel started this campaign of genocide in Gaza. Obviously, hospitals have been no exception to that indiscriminate bombing campaign. And meanwhile, the Israeli regime has failed miserably to convince the world that Hamas has been using hospitals, but it still uses this justification for why it is going after hospitals. Why do you think the regime has targeted so much delicate infrastructures like schools, hospitals, mosques in Gaza?
I mean, the answer is obvious: to bring about the destruction of civilian life and their cultural heritage, because we all know that their ultimate goal is to try to make life so unbearable as to push these people out of Gaza. And so it is an intentional calculation. And one thing is that I've seen so many videos of the latest raid in Al-Shifa, and while they claim that there were terrorists, all I heard is guns from the Israeli side, but no one was shooting back, which shows that there are no resistance fighters, terrorists, or whatever Israel claims in that hospital, and there are mostly civilians.
Right, and Isha, the United Nations Satellite Center, UNISAT, says that images this week show nearly 90,000 structures in Gaza have been destroyed, including 99 health facility centers. Can the regime really point to Hamas every time that it levels civilian infrastructure in Gaza?
That's what they do, but of course, no one. It hurts their credibility, because it is clear that they're not targeting military targets. They are targeting only civilian targets, and the overwhelming deaths are civilian, and the injuries are overwhelmingly civilian. So while they continue to use that justification, overwhelming video evidence, eyewitness evidence shows that they are basically targeting the population of Gaza as a whole.
And Isha, final thoughts with you. We've heard the U.S., we've heard voices from Paris and London, even Berlin, saying they're concerned at the United Nations. Everyone is so concerned about attacks and seizures on hospitals in Gaza. Yet, tell me, how shameful is it that everyone is so concerned in the West, in international organizations, yet no one has taken one step to put a stop to them and show any action to back up the concern?
Obviously, it is very shameful. And in the West, I mean, you can see it is hurting Biden electorally in a way. He can't walk anywhere without protests and on the Palestinian side. But worst of all, is that because they have not taken any action and they continue to ship more and more arms to Israel, it is a tacit endorsement of Israel's tactics. There are no red lines. There is nothing that Israel can do to cause these Western countries to stop supporting Israel. And that's the main message, besides some lip service that they are willing to give some of the time in some bodies.
All right. Thank you both for joining us. Stay safe to both of you. Moti Abu Musabit joining us out of the Gaza Strip. Anisha Krishnaswamy, podcaster and journalist, joining us from St. Petersburg, Russia. Thank you for tuning in. And goodbye for now. And welcome back, everyone. 27 leaders from the European Union have called for an immediate humanitarian pause in Gaza as a prelude to a sustainable ceasefire. Now, EU leaders made the request in a statement after a meeting of the European Council in Brussels. They also urge Israel not to launch its planned ground invasion into the southern city of Rafah, saying that it will worsen an already catastrophic humanitarian situation. They added the Rafah offensive will also prevent the provision of basic services from getting to civilians. EU leaders expressed deep concern about the catastrophic situation of children as well and the imminent risk of famine caused by insufficient entry of aid. They've called for full, rapid, and unhindered humanitarian access into Gaza. Political analyst Thay West out of Dallas, Texas in the U.S. believes a ceasefire in Gaza will not be established as long as the U.S. and some Western, other Western states, such as Germany, continue to give Israel weapons.
The United States, under President Joe Biden, they're not serious about Israel, because if they were serious, they would not be providing them with money, with weaponry, also with military intelligence with which to attack the Palestinians in Gaza. And of course, they would not be vetoing everything in the United Nations Security Council that is geared towards ending this situation in Gaza, which is a situation of mass genocide. I personally don't hold out too much hope for a ceasefire of any relevancy, because Netanyahu's goal is to eliminate as many Palestinians, regardless if they're women or children, as he can. And he's trying to do that. He's trying to run out the clock doing that. When the United States says or is talking about a ceasefire, well, Benjamin Netanyahu is saying, we're going to continue to attack Rafah. We're going to send boots on the ground into Rafah.
Israeli regime's forces have carried out new raids also in various areas of the occupied West Bank, including in the city of Tubas. They've clashed with Palestinian resistance fighters as well, defending those areas, and made some arrests. We were earlier joined by our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, for your details.
Every day we wake up to know that the Israeli forces had raided several areas across the occupied West Bank. We are not speaking about the specific areas, whether in the north or in the south or central, the occupied West Bank. Unfortunately, Israeli forces continue to storm villages, towns, and cities all across the occupied West Bank. What happened late on Thursday and early on Friday is that the Israeli forces had stormed the city of Tubas as well as Qalqilia. And in Al-Khalil, a number of villages the Israeli forces had stormed, like the village of Karmel, as well as Tuwani. And in Jenin, the Israelis had been storming the areas of Jenin, despite the fact that the Israeli military continued to carry out airstrikes against Palestinians there. And as experts are saying, it's even more easy for them to assassinate and kill those Palestinian fighters that the Israelis describe as wanted by the Israeli military. The Israelis stormed the village of Barta'a in Jenin, as well as Harabi and other areas like Fahmi, Kufr Ra'i, Umdar, and Ya'bad. So we are speaking about almost the majority of the villages to the south of Jenin had been stormed by the Israeli forces. And of course, the Israeli soldiers had arrested a number of Palestinians all across the occupied West Bank. A recent report by the Palestinian Commission of Prisoners Affairs, the Israeli forces had detained 7,700 Palestinians since the 7th of October, including, of course, children and women, and a number of Palestinians who had been released recently by the Israeli forces in the latest swap deal between the resistance group and Israel. Those had been again detained by the Israeli forces, including women.
Iran's foreign minister says the world has realized that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has reached the end of the line and is desperately trying to survive. Hossein Amir Abdullah Ihyan made the comment in a phone conversation with Hamas political bureau chief Ismail Haniyeh on Thursday. A top Iranian diplomat hailed Palestinian resistance against Israel. He said that Iran continues efforts in support of Palestinians at the international level. Haniyeh, on his part, appreciated Iran's stance on Palestine. The Hamas official emphasized resistance fighters enjoy high morale in confronting what he called Israel's war machine. Haniyeh also spoke about ongoing talks aimed at establishing a Gaza ceasefire. He said Israel is refusing to meet Hamas's conditions, which are legitimate demands of the Palestinian people. Therefore, he added, the regime's responsible for a possible failure of negotiations. The Iraqi resistance has urged Baghdad to accelerate the departure of U.S. forces from the country. Muslim Salem reports from the Iraqi capital.
After weeks of silence, Kitab Hezbollah Resistance Group, one of the biggest units within Iraq's popular mobilization units, reminds the government, as well as officials in the committee tasked with overseeing the withdrawal of U.S. military, that they should not grant immunity to the occupying forces, or else gates of hell will open.
These foreign forces have been violating our sovereignty for years now. In January 2020, Donald Trump ordered the assassination of our anti-terror commanders, Lieutenant General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Baghdad airport. And lately, they are violating it by assassination of Iraqi resistance commanders.
Kitab Hezbollah also warned that any removal of leaders of popular mobilization units must be decided by the PMU internally. It says acting otherwise would be a significant mistake.
Our government has made it clear on multiple occasions that the need for U.S. military forces have ended. Our security forces are capable of running the country's security system and face any threat. Washington is clearly trying to rally around the negotiations, and it is a clear attempt to delay their withdrawal from the country.
In January, the Iraqi resistance decided to halt the attacks on U.S. bases in Iraq and Syria. The attacks were started on October 19 in solidarity with Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Observers say that the suspension was to allow a climate of serenity for talks between Baghdad and Washington over the U.S. military presence. But as some have rightly noted, Washington has no intention to change its behavior in Iraq.
It is obvious that Washington is trying to gain more time to keep its military presence in Iraq. Our government needs to push forward and speed up the pace of negotiations to end the presence of these foreign forces and save our country's political, economic, and social stability.
On paper, the U.S. military forces are present in the country for advisory purposes, as well as training the Iraqi forces to fight Daesh terrorist group. However, in practice, the U.S. forces have shown a different objective by violating Iraqi sovereignty, attacking PMU positions, and killing top Iraqi commanders. Since the start of their operations in October, the resistance in Iraq has been pushing the government to end the U.S. military presence in the country. Also, they have time and again reiterated their solidarity with Palestinians. Muslim Salem, Baghdad.
Thank you for joining us, and goodbye for now. We'll be right back.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsetodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsetodayEnglish.
Defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
On March 1st, Iran held elections for its parliament. More than 25 million people went to the polls to choose the next members of the legislative branch, which has a direct influence on the country's foreign policy. The rise of some new figures has already changed dramatically the configuration of the next parliament. They've challenged the authority of established figures such as Mohammad Baqir Ghalibaf, the Speaker of the Parliament, who has a long political career, including running for president and serving as Tehran's mayor. But can they change the course of the country in the international arena? Or will they keep the status quo? Sanctions, the Iran nuclear deal, and the Afghans living in Iran are but a few issues related to Iran's foreign policy that the upcoming parliament has to deal with as matters of great urgency. The 2024 parliamentary elections have had some surprises for the country and the world that might affect the parliament's general approach towards issues of international significance. The three of top vote-getters in the capital city of Tehran, comprised of clerics Mahmoud Nabavian and Hamid Rassai, who clinched first and third places respectively, and Amir Hossein Sabati, a young conservative activist and news show host who came in second place. Most notably, the election brought a stunning reversal of fortune for the current parliamentary speaker Ghalibaf. Once the top vote-getter with 1,265,287 votes in the 2020 parliamentary elections, he experienced a quick fall to fourth place this time around, securing only 447,905 votes. The three top vote-getters in Tehran are all members of the Front of Islamic Revolution Stability. Its politicians have track records of opposing both moderate conservatives and reformists, and were the loudest critics of the Rouhani administration. The top vote-getter in Tehran, Nabavian, is a former parliamentarian known for his rigid stance on foreign policy, especially his fierce opposition to the nuclear negotiations that resulted in the 2015 nuclear deal, known also as the JCPOA. This is Dr. Kamran Ghazanfari, a senior expert on international relations, who has been elected as a representative of Tehran for the next parliament. It is said that the new parliament doesn't deeply believe in the JCPOA as an agreement that could solve the country's problem. In other words, it could be an anti-JCPOA parliament, so to speak. What do you think?
برجام که به واقع همون چند سال قبل مرد.
As for the JCPOA, the agreement died a few years ago and nothing is left of it except for its name. As you may remember, the leader of the Islamic Revolution referred to the JCPOA in March 2015 in the holy city of Mashhad as a complete loss. What President Rouhani and Foreign Minister Zarif called an international achievement actually caused great damage to the country. As the leader put it, it was a complete loss. Naturally, the 11th parliament was not a fan of the JCPOA, and the next parliament should pay no attention to it. The deal was a non-starter from the very beginning.
The results of the March elections will certainly have its impacts on the direction of Iran's political landscape, with implications for both domestic policies and international relations. Mr. Abolfazl Zohrevand is a seasoned diplomat who has been working for the Iranian Ministry of Foreign Affairs for almost four decades. He is a former ambassador of Iran to Rome and Kabul, who has been elected as a representative of Tehran in the next parliament. Basically, what are the building blocks of Iran's foreign policy?
Pinpointing threats and opportunities constitutes a key part of any country's foreign policy. We should be able to determine our opportunities and turn them into tangible achievements. For example, selling oil, capturing a market, or establishing a cultural relationship with a certain country. This could be the main mission of foreign policy.
Iran's parliament has a long history dating back to the early 20th century, when the country underwent a period of constitutional revolution. Since then, especially after the 1979 Islamic Revolution, the Iranian parliament has played a significant role in shaping the country's foreign policy priorities. Following the revolution, Iran's foreign policy underwent a radical shift, with a focus on anti-Western sentiments and support for freedom-seeking movements across the region. In this regard, the Iranian parliament has played a key role in supporting these policies and shaping Iran's foreign relations. This is Ruhollah Izzatkhah, a representative of Tehran in the 11th parliament, who has been re-elected for the next parliament.
About the resistance movement, the previous parliaments were not as active as they were supposed to be, maybe because they thought that the government was active enough in this regard. But I think the parliament should get involved, especially in the Palestinian cause. It has to take a strong stance on it and shape effective relations in favor of the resistance movement, along with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the National Security Council, and other related organs.
The country's support for resistance groups such as Hezbollah in Lebanon and Hamas in Palestine has had positive effects, such as promoting solidarity among countries in the region that share similar anti-Western, anti-hegemonic sentiments. The U.S. in this sense has always been a problem in Iran's foreign policy. Tehran insists that Washington should stop its hegemonic ambitions in West Asia and considers it as the root cause of regional instability. But will the new parliament take direct action so as to confront the U.S.? Or is there any tendency among the top vote-getters to bury the hatchet? Now, the relations with the United States is still considered as a main challenge in Iran's foreign policy. How do you think the new parliament plans to tackle this issue?
آمریکا از همون ابتدای پیروزی انقلاب اسلامی بنا رو بر خصومت با ما گذاشت.
Just after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, the United States took an antagonistic attitude towards our nation. They began arming opposition groups inside the country, supporting terrorist groups and separatists inside and outside the country. And they tried to sow division among people with the aim of pushing the country towards civil war. All these subversive measures were followed by their help to Saddam Hussein to wage a bloody war against Iran, which took 8 years. After the imposed war, none of the following administrations, from the Bush administration up to now, took an amicable approach towards the Islamic Republic. On the contrary, each one hatched a plot to topple the Islamic Republic. They imposed all kinds of pressures on the country to topple the established system in Iran. How do you expect us to talk and negotiate with them without wasting our breath?
There's plenty more to be said, but first a quick media review to give other outlets a chance to get a word in.
Hello everyone, welcome to the news section of the program. Here, we'll go over some news headlines. March the 1st polls fueled by patriotism and political awareness. Mohammad Baqir Ghalibaf underscored the robust turnout in both parliamentary and assembly of experts elections, expressing gratitude towards the Iranian populace and election officials for their contributions to the democratic process. He specifically lauded the efforts of security and police forces for their astute management in ensuring the election's security. In his address, Speaker Ghalibaf emphasized the accountability of parliament representatives to all constituents, urging them to prioritize public interests over partisan agendas. Iran leader says new parliament brings fresh hopes for country. The leader made the remarks in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts in Tehran on Sunday. Ayatollah Khamenei said a new parliament is like fresh blood in Iran's political and social structure. The leader urged the newly elected Iranian lawmakers to be cautious not to embitter the nation and the political atmosphere of the country. Ayatollah Khamenei emphasized that divisive wars, quarrels, and hostilities, which are favorable to the enemy, can kill the sweetness of the new parliament, advising the new lawmakers to be very careful. The leader stressed that Iran should always stand at the forefront of the battle against global arrogance and added that the country should strengthen its fight every day and never allow anyone to defeat it. Iran says willing to improve ties with neighboring countries. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, said Tehran is willing to improve relations with neighboring countries. In a speech during the Third Tehran Dialogue Forum 2022, Amir Abdollahian said Tehran welcomes rebuilding trust and constructive cooperation with its neighbors, especially the Persian Gulf countries. And that brings us to the end of this section. Let's go back to the main narrative.
Iran's parliament, also known as the Islamic Consultative Assembly, has the power to influence and oversee the government's diplomatic decisions and engagements with other nations. What do you think the next parliament's priority is going to be in terms of the country's foreign policy?
The country needs to revise its economic policies and take initiatives instead of being on the sidelines. This can be done under the rubric of economic diplomacy. The government needs to have a detailed guideline in this regard and stop acting on an ad hoc basis. The parliament should enter this area by passing comprehensive laws for the country's economic diplomacy. At the same time, we should tap into the potential of our neighboring states and simultaneously establish systematic economic ties with other countries. For example, we can establish even stronger ties with Russia as it seeks our advice on circumventing sanctions, especially after the outbreak of the war with Ukraine.
One of the key functions of the Iranian parliament in shaping the country's foreign policy is through the ratification of treaties and international agreements. As outlined in the Iranian constitution, all international agreements must be approved by the parliament before they can be implemented. This process ensures that the interests and concerns of the Iranian people are taken into consideration before committing to any international commitments.
Concerning foreign policy, everything begins from the country's interaction with its neighbors. Since Mr. Raisi came to office, we've had two key achievements. First, we officially joined the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And second, we officially joined BRICS. That said, these memberships are just the first steps, and we need to turn them into opportunities. So far, we haven't been very successful in this regard, and I think the next parliament should take proper action. If the administration needs any special support, the parliament should provide it as soon as possible so we can reap the benefits of such memberships.
Additionally, the parliament has the authority to reject or amend any international agreement that is not in the best interest of the country.
از این مذاکرات چه حاصلی شد؟
What was the fruit of the nuclear talks? That's our question. What was the biggest achievement of the nuclear talks? What has been the result of direct or indirect talks with the Americans? Have the Americans abandoned their hostile policies against the Islamic Republic? Have they abandoned their hegemonic policies in the region? If you look at what is unfolding in Gaza, you'll find out the answer. The fact is, the Americans have not and will not abandon their hegemonic policies. Over the past few months, they have lent their unconditional support to the Israeli regime. The majority of bombs and ammunition the regime is using against the innocent people in Gaza are provided by the US. Despite what they say, they have no respect for human rights at all. So I think we have to take a more revolutionary stance against both the US government and its puppet regimes and treat them from a stronger position.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
Furthermore, the Iranian parliament plays a crucial role in overseeing the government's foreign policy decisions and actions. Through its various committees, such as the National Security and Foreign Policy Committee, the parliament conducts regular evaluations of the government's foreign relations and policies. This oversight mechanism ensures transparency and accountability in the conduct of Iran's diplomacy. We also talked to Mr. Vali Dadashi, a member of the 10th Parliament Islamic from the electorate of Astara, Gilan, in the north of Iran. Mr. Dadashi has also been elected for the next parliament.
According to the Iranian constitution, the parliament has a supervisor role in addition to representing the electorate and making laws. In this sense, the parliament should make sure that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs is pursuing the country's official foreign policy. We have to ensure that the ministry is fulfilling its mission of developing relations with other countries across the world. The parliament can and should help the ministry facilitate international agreements and accords on condition that they would be to the benefit of the Iranian nation.
Moreover, the Iranian parliament has the power to initiate and pass legislation that directly impacts the country's foreign policy. For example, the parliament can introduce and enact laws related to economic sanctions, trade agreements, and diplomatic relations with other countries. By drafting and passing legislation, the parliament can influence the direction and priority of Iran's foreign policy.
As for our relations with the US, we had a bitter experience in recent years. I'm talking about the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA. It was a bitter lesson for us and an eye-opening experience for the rest of the world that the Americans do not honor their promises and that they are not even honest with their closest allies. I think post-JCPOA, Iran will have fundamental changes in its relations with the US. In this parliament, we ratified the Strategic Action Plan to lift sanctions and protect Iranian nation's interests. The Rouhani administration tried to prevent the law from being passed, but the parliament passed it anyway, and according to the leader of the revolution, saved the country from limbo.
In addition to its legislative functions, the Iranian parliament also plays a role in promoting dialogue and diplomacy with other countries. Through its parliamentary diplomacy initiatives, the Iranian parliament engages in exchanges with foreign legislators and officials to promote mutual understanding and cooperation. These interactions can help build bridges between Iran and other nations, foster peace and stability in the region, and advance Iran's foreign policy objectives. How can the upcoming parliament help the government in its foreign policy agenda?
Parliament has a significant capacity of its own. There is an important committee called the National Security and Foreign Policy Committee, which is composed of political elites. At the same time, there are over 20 inter-parliamentary friendship groups in the parliament. This capacity can help any administration in their interacting with other countries. As a national organ that represents the whole nation, the parliament can have independent relations with other countries' parliament. This way, the parliament can bridge the gap with the target country, preparing the ground for diplomats to deepen the country's relations with the rest of the world.
Iran's nuclear program, a key aspect of its foreign policy agenda, has been a source of contention, leading to sanctions and diplomatic tensions with the Western bloc. The JCPOA, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, is a landmark agreement over Iran's peaceful nuclear program. Signed in 2015 by Iran, the United States, United Kingdom, France, China, Russia, and Germany, the JCPOA was seen as a significant diplomatic achievement. However, the agreement has faced challenges, particularly with the United States under President Donald Trump withdrawing from the deal in 2018. The withdrawal of the U.S. from the agreement has strained relations between Iran and the other signatories, leaving the nuclear deal in a moribund state. Will the rise of figures such as Nabavian, who were critical of the deal from the very beginning, be the final nail in the agreement's coffin? Should we brace ourselves for any radical changes with respect to the new parliament's foreign policy approach?
Given the initial results, it has become clear that almost half of the current representatives have failed to win a seat in the next parliament. It means that people expect serious changes. Although the leader of the Islamic Revolution called the 11th parliament the Revolutionary Parliament, in comparison to the 10th parliament, which was in line with the Rouhani administration's pro-Western policies, it seems that the 11th parliament has not fulfilled people's expectations, and it seems that they expect an even more revolutionary parliament for the future.
Mr. Zohrevan, on the other hand, believes that Iran has to balance out its relations with both the East and the West. A key component of Iran's foreign policy in the recent years has been pivot to the East. To what extent do you think that the next parliament is willing to better relations with the West in an attempt to create a diplomatic balance?
When we are talking about the West, we should look at it as a whole. We should enumerate both its positive and its negative aspects. We should not put all our eggs in one basket. It's not to the benefit of our country. Take China, for example. Although the country is not always on good terms with the United States of America, it is the main exporter of goods to the U.S. We should take a realistic approach in our foreign policy. We don't need to be perfectly good with a country before benefiting from ties with that country. We should balance our relations with both the West and the East for the benefit of our country.
Afghan refugees in Iran have been a pressing issue for Tehran, an issue with significant social, economic, and political implications. Will the upcoming parliament have any plans for it? The influx of Afghan refugees into Iran dates back to the Soviet-Afghan War in the 1980s, when millions of Afghans sought refuge in neighboring countries, including Iran. The situation was further exacerbated by the rise of the Taliban in the 1990s and the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. Despite international efforts to address the issue, the presence of Afghans in Iran remains a complex and challenging problem, with far-reaching consequences for both countries. Another serious concern for the Iranian nation is the amount of Afghan refugee population, which is estimated to be around 7 to 8 million people. What do you think the next parliament plans to deal with this issue?
First of all, we need to have a transparent policy on migration. We should know exactly what we have to do with Afghans who live in Iran. Needless to say, they should live in Iran legally.
They should have legal permission for it. We should have detailed information about them, their jobs, their homes, their incomes, etc., etc. And we have to make sure that they are obeying the country's rules and regulations.
The sheer number of Afghans living in Iran, estimated as high as 7 to 8 million, has strained Iran's resources and infrastructure, leading sometimes, if not always, to social tension, competition for jobs, and overcrowded urban areas. The presence of Afghan refugees has also had security implications. From a political perspective, the issue of Afghans in Iran has become a contentious topic, with debates over citizenship rights, deportation policies, and international obligations.
The government has taken measures in this regard. Tehran has repeatedly asked the Afghan authorities to move toward democracy. I think with a democratic political system in Afghanistan, Afghans living in Iran will go back to their own country. If they feel social security in their homeland, they will return to Afghanistan. Tehran has discussed this issue with the Afghan government. This is, I think, the root solution to the problem.
Overall, the Iranian parliament is a crucial institution in shaping and overseeing the country's foreign policy. Through its legislative functions, oversight mechanism, and diplomatic engagement, the parliament ensures that Iran's foreign policy is in line with the interests and aspirations of the Iranian people. By working collaboratively with the government, the parliament can contribute to a more effective and principled foreign policy that promotes Iran's national interests and contributes to global peace and stability.
That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Please do join us again same times to see what else is on. Till next time, take care.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. 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 کتاب
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant factor
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام
امامت is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulema's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Please stay tuned.
حدیث از پیغمبر اکرم فرمود صائم وقتی که یشتم شتمی بهش میشه فحشی بهش داده میشه
In a beautiful hadith by Prophet Muhammad we read if a person who is fasting hears some foul words or insults and he or she only says salamun alaykum I am fasting then a veil of light will protect him or her from the hellfire This means that controlling anger during the month of Ramadan results in divine rewards. This self-control helps us to avoid haram looks, haram income, and haram food or drink.
رمضان تقویت اراده است فرصت آشتی با خداست
The holy month of Ramadan is the best chance to strengthen our willpower against unlawful or haram things The holy month of Ramadan is the best chance to fulfill our religious duties This is the best time to enter the realm of Allah and enjoy his blessings in our life Ramadan is the best time to reconcile with spirituality and divinity This is the best time for showing good behavior towards others. This is also the best opportunity for those who want to reform in terms of spiritual and religious obligations. We must not miss this chance given to us by Allah in the holy month of Ramadan. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulema's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Of the soil from the blood and the ashes, it speaks with me the sound of the rain from the battle and the victory.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.